Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we talk with Bill Russell about the release of the Sideshow CD. We review Hamilton at the Public Theater, The Lion at Culture Project, New York Shakespeare Exchange's production of Titus Andronicus, The Snow Orchid, Pretty Filthy by the Civilians, the King Company production of John and Jen, and Jesse Norman in Hooray for Love at Carnegie Hall. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, February 22nd, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His new one is going to be The Great Parade, which will be released on April 7th. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
With us this morning, we have a very special guest joining us. Bill Russell is with us. Our Broadway fans know Bill from Sideshow and the two incarnations of the Broadway production, and the CD is being released... I guess it's being released on Tuesday, Bill. Is that correct?
Yes. Maybe it's Wednesday, the 24th.
Tuesday. Yeah, I don't know why, but CDs come out on Tuesday, or they try to schedule a release like the olden days, you know, for some reason. So, Bill, thanks for getting up on a Sunday morning, but you're not really getting up because you're in rehearsal for your next project, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
What are you doing?
Well, I'm writing lyrics for a musical version of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. And we've been in a workshop for the last 2 weeks, and we have presentations tomorrow and Tuesday.
Well, you know, are they industry type of presentations, or what are you just getting up?
Yes, yeah, industry.
Well, that's great. Good to hear. You know, and in the midst of this, you are releasing this CD of the... do we call it the revival cast of Sideshow? What's your preference?
Yeah, that's what I'd refer to it as, sure.
And so I wanted to let listeners know that Broadway Records is putting out this thing, and you'll be able to get it on Tuesday, but fans of Sideshow are going to be able to hear an unreleased song, aren't they?
Yes. We have a bonus track of... Emily Patchett, Aaron Davey, singing a title song we wrote for the show. They're accompanied by Henry. We wrote the show for the song for the original production, but it was never in that version. And then when we started the process with this version, the first production was at the La Jolla Playhouse the fall before last, and we put the song in there, and we took it out when we went to D.C. So it's a great song. It wasn't that we took it out because we didn't like it. It was more plot reasons and structure of the show.
Well, Peter can tell us lots of great songs are lost for many different reasons. Isn't that correct, Peter?
It sure is. But we're delighted that we're going to get more of Sideshow rather than less. Now, Bill, I'm sure you know that many moons ago, 45 years ago, in fact, when they did the original cast album of Company, there was a film being shot of the session. There was a very dramatic session with Elaine Stritch not being able to do her song. If there were a filming of your recording session of either Sideshow, what would have been the most dramatic moment that people would have seen?
Well, the session was really very smooth. You know, the Emily and Aaron, who play the Hilton sisters, they're huge, huge roles. And they had just done a whole weekend of performances So I'd say the most dramatic moment was just they were so tired. but they just kept pumping it out. They're real troopers. But there was no fireworks or anything like that. I mean, we've all been together as a group doing this for a while now, and it was quite smooth.
Well, that company cast recording documentary, of course, is amazing. But I've often heard it said that people have tried to do similar things, but it's never like even a patch on that, because they're all waiting for the Stritch moment.
Right. And
it's just not, you know, what are the chances that something like that is going to happen? I've seen they did one for Guys and Dolls. Do you remember that?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's fine. It's just kind of dull. You know,
right.
I mean, recordings are usually dull unless mm-hmm. Elaine Stritch is involved.
Exactly. And we wanted her for the bearded lady, but she wasn't available.
So
there was some filming of the session, and there's a promotional video. It's about 12 minutes long. That's going to be released on Tuesday, sort of a behind the scenes look at the making of the album, which is very good. But we don't have any Elaine moments, unfortunately.
Bill, I was just going to mention that I saw the 12-minute video on your Facebook page the other day, and I watched
where it. I was not supposed to put it. I just found out. Anyway, sorry.
That's why it's gone, you know? But you got to watch it. Well, as soon as you see something very interesting, you have to watch it right away, because these things disappear. So,
yeah, that's right.
But I think it was the engineer on the album was talking about how the girls never, you know, sing 90% of the score, and they worked so hard to make this recording. And I thought that was very, it was a good insight, because you don't think about how much these two women, and, you know, are up there and have to sing for, I mean, how long were the recording sessions? Did you get it in a week, or how, what did you do?
Oh, we basically did it in one day.
One day.
As the albums are generally done, you know, original cast recordings, they're done on the day off. So we did it on a Monday, pretty much the whole thing. We picked up that bonus track later, but we did it all in the day.
Well, that answers my next question, because I wanted to know, did you do it during the run of the show, or did you do it after?
So yes, we did it at the end of November. We wanted to do it earlier, it just because of the way the schedule was, we just couldn't fit it in until then.
Sure. And, you know, you have the inevitable comparisons from the first production and to the second production. What was that evolutionary change like when the different ways that you made changes to the production?
It was absolutely thrilling. I mean, working with Bill Condon and Henry, we started this process for this version in 2007, and we did a lot of work then, and did a reading that was produced by the Roundabout, and then Bill Condon did the Twilight films. He was hired for those, and he shot them together and edited them separately. But it was 3 years there where we really weren't able to work on the show, and during that time, the Kennedy Center expressed interest in doing a revival, and that led to all of this. But the process of rethinking the show was just so exciting. I've always had a huge talent crush on Bill Condon, and I have such respect for him as a writer and director. And our first meeting together, he had this pile of books about sideshows and vaudeville. Plus, he had asked Henry for everything we'd ever written for the show, and had looked at it all, and he was mentioning songs in that meeting that we didn't even remember writing, because we've written a ton of stuff over the years working on this. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Bill, I have a question. Actually, somebody brought this up. Some shows are available for license in two versions. You know, that like the original, and then later on there was a revisal, if you will. Do you know yet if this one will be available in both versions, or is it that you all feel that you just the current version is the one that reflects what you would like to be done?
Well, I do feel that way. But Samuel French, who licensed the show, will have the original available if people specifically request it.
Okay.
But if people would just request Sideshow, they'll get the revised version.
Gotcha.
And I, frankly, I mean, artistically, I prefer that. I, you know, we didn't do all this work to make it not as good. So I do think we improved it, and a lot of people felt that way. So,
So, Bill, I want you to think long and hard about this next answer before you answer it. Now, knowing that I played Terry in a number of productions and you had come seen them, who was your favorite Terry?
Gee, I will have to think long and hard about that. I would say
you don't have to say it if you.
It's a tie between you and Ryan Silverman and Jeff McCarthy. A three-way tie.
That's a good idea.
Love them all.
Diplomatic.
It's just like my children's soccer games. We all get a trophy.
That's right.
That's right, James. Which of your children do you love most? I mean, you know, so
really.
The ones that look the most like
you know,
me.
Terry. Terry is the role that when I've seen productions, that in some ways is the most challenging to cast. It's the leading men out there are hard to find, and you three were. I've seen some other good ones too, but I've also seen some that weren't so great. So.
Tell us a little bit more about what you have coming up with Brave New World. Tell what's that about?
Well, it's based on the famous Aldous Huxley novel, which was written in the 30s and set 500 years in the future. And childbirth is completely handled in test tubes. And so there isn't marriage, there isn't procreation. And they sort of control the population through sex. They have required orgies and drugs, this drug called Soma. And adapting it for the stage has been an interesting challenge because the novel, for instance, the protagonist isn't introduced until halfway through the book, and you can't really do that on stage. So there's been some challenges, but it's really been another great team and really good process.
What's always interesting about looking at books that dealt with the future that were written a long, long time ago is how much the writer got right and how much the writer got wrong.
Indeed,
what did Aldous Huxley get right when you say, wow, you know, as time has gone on, I mean, I know we're not 500 years in the future, but he saw that coming while, oh, wow, you know, he didn't see cell phones were coming and there are people on landlines, that type of thing. Are there any things like that in that you've noticed along the way while adapting?
Well, he was amazingly prescient, and a lot of what he foresaw has already happened. And now we're moving at warp speed. So, you know, 500 years later, who knows, but no, he was very prescient, but there are some funny things in the book that like this riot breaks out and they run to a phone book to call some department. And then just that idea is kind of hilarious now. And another thing that's interesting, the society where childbirth is totally a mechanized process, really. You would think that they would encourage gay sex. I mean, because they control the population. And that's something that Huxley really didn't foresee at all, how important gay issues would be.
I'm just looking up now. I've never read Brave New World, but I'm looking up and I'm seeing several movies or TV movies with that title. I'm not sure if they're all based on that, but there is one that's definitely based on the book from 1998. And guess who's starring it? Peter Gallagher.
Oh, wow. Yeah. No, I haven't seen that.
Peter Gallagher, Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, good for that. Yeah,
gotta check that out.
Yeah, I will.
How'd you get involved? Did somebody come to you? Was it your idea? What?
Yeah, they came to me. I actually was commissioned to write lyrics, and that's really nice because you don't get paid up front very often in this business. So, that's been great.
And you have a cast with Justin Guarini and Leah Hawking, Allison Luff, Zach Resnick, and Jason Tam. among others.
So you have a pretty
talented group of folks there. And John McDaniel wrote the music with Johnny Rockwell?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. Ben Andron did the book as well, the adaptation. And you have your presentations coming up, so I'm going to let you run. But thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning to tell us about the Sideshow CD and some other stuff.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, and I'm so happy with the Sideshow album. It just really came out so well. So.
Oh, that's great. Everybody can get it at BroadwayRecords.com, as well as Amazon and iTunes and all the other typical outlets. So let's support our theater folks. All right. Well, Bill, have a great rest of the day, and we'll speak with you soon.
All right. Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Tangled knot be untied. Now it's up to you to get Violet to agree. You should be free from her side.
Only two more days until they are when excitement continues to grow. Three of them up there as to exchange vows. Oh, what a great wedding show.
So, I don't know if you guys have seen the internet lately, but there's a lot of buzz coming out of Lafayette Street with a new musical called Hamilton by Lin-Manuel Miranda. Michael and Peter have gotten a chance to see it, and why don't we start off with Peter? What do you think about it?
I think it's damn good. Now, while I hate anachronistic music in musicals, therefore I should hate the rap that's used here. But you know, what's fascinating to me is that rap sounds inherently angry and agitated. So it seems acceptable for the periods of intense tumult that is experienced here by the 13 colonies in the first act and the new nation they become in the second act. Much of the time, the rap is a tiny bit slower than what we hear blaring out of the radios of cars with open windows on the streets, but that helps us to understand what's being said. But even when we don't get every word, and believe me, there are plenty of times we don't get every word, we know enough about history, well, I hope we do anyway, to see us through. What's really skillful is that when rap seems to run the risk of running away with the show, when we've had too much of it, a true song comes in. And I have to say that every song that came in was a song that I thought was terrific, stunning. It starts out with a lot of finger snaps, more finger snaps than you hear in the Addams Family and West Side Story combined. You know, but I think that's really matched by the audience with the toe taps that accompany the music. This really is the grandson of Hair in many respects. And telling the story, for one thing, leads us to find out things that we didn't know about Hamilton's personal life. And that turns out to be very significant, because early in the show, when the woman he loves sings this tender song, we feel so bad for her, knowing that, after all, he's going to die by the end of the show. However, things happen in the second act that will not make that so terrible for her. I don't want to give too much away, but this is a real leap forward for Lin-Manuel Miranda. Now, I mean, while watching it occurred to me, you know, there are so many musical theater writers who do a show and then the next one is substantially better. This is not a knock against In the Heights. In the Heights was a fine musical, but this one, I think, is substantially stronger. So so I think it's going to do extraordinarily well on Broadway, and I do think it should move because it has so many good ideas in it. Aaron Burr has a wonderful song essentially talking about the room where it happens, where deals are made and deals are brokered, and he says, "I want to be in the room where it happened," and he's not in the room where it happened. And so this song is almost like the grandson of someone in a tree from Pacific Overtures. for all this talk about how revolutionary this show is, no pun intended with the American Revolution, there are some very standard musical theater template issues in place here. For example, in the great musical theater tradition, after a funny and charming song, matters become deadly serious, and that does happen. I think the direction by Tom Hale and the stage pictures are among the most beautiful I have ever seen. I'll add choreographer Andy Blankenbuehler to that too. Seamless, sure-handed, wonderful pictures, and Howell Binkley's extraordinary lighting. I don't want to think how many days the teching must have taken to do it, because it is so magnificent. So yes, they make room for a Jersey joke. No question about that. But what's really good, the best byproduct perhaps of Hamilton, is that it makes you want to know even more about the man. And I won't be surprised if the musical helps Ron Chernow's book, Alexander Hamilton, which inspired this musical, back on the bestseller list. I say come to Broadway now. Don't lose the momentum. Make it happen right now and make it a much more interesting Tony race.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
I think it's a great, great show. I think it's a brilliant mixture of traditional forms and new styles. I harken back to In the Heights. I thought, I mean, I'm not really such a fan of rap. It's certainly not the kind of stuff that's heard on the radio, but I thought it worked beautifully in both shows. But I noticed in the Heights, and the same is true here. There's actually a lot more rap, I would say, in Hamilton than in the Heights. But it seemed to me that really no one is rapping for more than, like, I would say really not much more than 1 or 2 minutes at a time before you get at least a snippet of somebody singing a melody. And not only that, but the music that backs the raps is frequently more melodic than what you'll hear in a modern day rap tune. So I think he really has almost created his own form here for the musical. And I think it works beautifully. I wouldn't say I got every word, but partly due to the excellent sound system.
It is good. Yeah, I agree.
I really got the vast majority of the lyrics, and that obviously helped. As fast as they are, you know, I was amazed at several points in Act One. I'm like, these people, they can't take a breath in the wrong place. They'd be completely off. You know, there are so many words per minute, per second almost, but they come through. It's an incredible achievement. Aside from the tech issues, the tech excellence that Peter mentioned, there's also a turntable. In fact, I think it's a concentric turntable, and that has to be timed down to the second, obviously. Those tech rehearsals must have been really something. But it worked. Everything worked beautifully. Not a single misstep. I agree about the choreography. There is so much choreography in the show. I would almost think in this case that co-director credit would not be inappropriate. But Thomas Kail does do a fantastic job, and so does Andy Blankenbuehler, the director. The cast is uniformly superb. Philippa Sue, was nice to see her again after Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet. People we've seen before. Chris Jackson, who plays Washington, was in In the Heights and also in Holla If You Hear Me. So he's had rap Broadway experience before. Even the people I'm less familiar with, David Diggs, who plays Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and of course Brian Darcy James has, as I'm sure you've heard, it's only three scenes, I believe, three little song scenes as King George, but he absolutely knocks them out of the park. I'm so glad I got to see him, because he is, as I think we all know, leaving to do Something Rotten. So But I hope.
Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't mention him. What's really wonderful about his song, You'll Be Back, the first one, it's the same song with different lyrics each time. But what I love about the song, You'll Be Back, it sounds like a bubblegum melody from the 60s. And it really is a song that could almost, with only a few words different, be the type of song that a spurned lover sings to his girlfriend saying, You'll Be Back. That's what's great about it. It's done in that type of style. So it has that wonderful double dose of entertainment to it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the whole conceit of it, is that George is the spurned lover. And, you know, the colonies are the betrayer. I thought it was great. And he such a subtly hilarious performance. Just little things he does with his mouth and his eyes, these little expressions. It's just great. Oh, and I have to mention one of my all-time favorites, who I guess I don't see that often, Renee Elise Goldsberry as Angelica Schuyler. She was fantastic too. The men's parts, I would, in general, are, I would say, better and larger in the show, but the women really do play an important role also. And she and Philippa Sue were really superb. I can't, it was thrilling. It really was thrilling to be there for something that has so much buzz, and I would say completely deserved. So many times things are overhyped. I don't think this is one of those situations.
All right. Well, it's a very, very difficult ticket to get.
Well, is it ever? Yeah. Mm.
And as we've seen on social media and in the New York Post, tickets are going upwards of $1,000 through the scalpers and things like that. But the Public Theater has two different programs that you should check into if you really want to go see this. One is called, what is it called? Hamilton for a Hamilton. So Hamilton is on the $10 bill, in the United States at least. Today's Tix is offering some sort of lottery system for that. And there's also a $20 ticket lottery. Those things will be on their website, and I'll link to their website on the show notes so that you can check it out if you have the ability to get down to the Public Theater and do these sort of lottery things to go see it. Sounds like it's...
A friend of mine last night mentioned, he said that they have an app. That's how he put it. Some kind of an app. I guess maybe the app through which you you apply for the virtual lottery.
Yeah, Today's Tix is the app.
Okay.
Yeah, and you could do that. And it involves downloading the app to your phone and then signing up there and tweeting about it or something like that. So it's kind of a marketing ploy for the Public Theater and Today's Tix, as well as the ability for you to get a $10 ticket to a show that is selling $120 tickets. So,
is it really?
Yeah. I don't know how Mr. Papp feels about that, spinning in his grave for $120 tickets.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, we talk about the mission of the Public Theater was
Sure.
difficult to make those things line up. Anyway, moving forward, Michael got a chance to see The Lion. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about The Lion?
The Lion has been extremely well received. It played, I guess, earlier this year or last year, and now it has come back to the Lynn Redgrave Theater at Culture Project or 45 Bleecker. It's a one person show by Benjamin Scheuer, who also wrote the music and the lyrics. And it's basically the story of his life. I'm not sure how much would qualify as spoilers in this case. There are at least two major life events that happen to him that are pretty extraordinary, and he kind of tells us about that in music and lyrics. I thought that the quality of the music and the lyrics was excellent, entirely excellent, sort of a modern folk style, I would generally say, but really melodic and very, very clever lyrics. And he himself is a wonderfully engaging and charismatic performer. I guess I just felt that it was to hear all of that sadness in sort of one thing after another, it seemed a little, I don't want to say manipulative, because that's a tricky word, but it just seemed like it was a little much at times. And I didn't love the show the way that many, 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 many people seemed to. It got one of those, what really seemed like a sincere, spontaneous standing ovation. But it's well worth seeing if you get down to the Lynn Redgrave, which is such a wonderful space. Also, I love that. I love that space. I love that it's named after her. So yes, Benjamin Scheuer, The Lion.
All right. That's at the Lynn Redgrave, which is at the Culture Project on 45 Bleecker Street.
Yes.
And that space has undergone a lot of different names over the last 20 some odd years, hasn't it?
Well, they used to just call it 45 Bleecker, yeah, 45 Bleecker, which was, you know, it certainly made things simpler.
All right. So let's move forward into Titus Andronicus. I can't get that out. Titus Andronicus. Both Michael and Peter got a chance to see it. So, Peter?
I've weighed in. I've talked about it.
Did you?
Yes, he did. That's largely why I went on Peter's recommendation.
Uh-oh.
No, it was wonderful.
Oh, I'm glad.
It was just wonderful. It's funny, James, when you stumbled on the title there, I was thinking, what if you did a spoof of it and called it Titus Androgynous?
Ah.
That would be interesting.
Who would we cast in that?
I don't know. There was no gender blind casting in this one, but it was a wonderful, excellent, very creative production with superb acting throughout, and just great direction by Ross Williams. The interesting thing here is the overall concept was based on the set and design when you walked in, was as if it were you were sitting in a carnival or a circus. But that is the one thing about it that I didn't feel added anything. I wasn't sure why they did that, and it didn't seem to me that necessarily that the staging that they did or even necessarily some of the costumes that they had in the show were in line with that. So I didn't think it was a negative, but I didn't think it added anything to have that concept. Everything else about it was just great. The company is the New York Shakespeare Exchange, which I believe this is my first experience of them. I'm definitely going to see them again. Peter can say again how really just everyone's speech, everyone's commitment, the energy level. It was really quite something. Let me just single out some people. I mentioned before that Vince Gatton, who played Saturnitis, is a friend of mine. So full disclosure there, but he was great. I'm telling you, he really was. And Titus himself was this fellow named Brendan Averett. Really very, very strong presence, very well done. And there was so many good people in it. Gretchen Egolf, whom I have not seen on stage in quite some time, was really great as Tamara. So it was wonderful to see her again. And I just thought it was well done. I've been seeing a lot of Shakespeare lately. And this is the first time I have ever seen that play staged. And so that was really a privilege just on that level. But to have it so well done was really extremely gratifying.
Michael, have you ever seen Henry IV Part 2?
I believe so. Why?
Oh, that seems to be the one that is the toughest for so many people because people tend to do Henry IV Part 1. And for me, it was the last one I saw of the 37 or 38, depending on how you're counting. So I was just wondering if you were missing that one since you said this was the first time you saw Titus. So I thought that was possible.
There might be a couple of others. I should go through the list because I know you do that a lot. I should really go through the list and see what haven't I seen. Mm-hmm. At this point.
All right, so let's move forward. Peter got a chance to see the Snow Orchard, so Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Snow Orchard, Joe Cantaro. This is a reasonably famous play, and having come from an Italian-American background, as did Mr. Pintaro, as I imagine, to some degree, Robert Cuccioli, our Jekyll and Hyde of Jekyll and Hyde fame. I can certainly say that he understands Italian-American families, but this is the most dysfunctional one of all. Whoa. I'm telling you, I have never, ever, ever seen a family on stage, don't tell me about the Tyrones, that have so many issues and fight so much and have such strife. So you're in for that if you go. Now, the situation is one that certainly holds water. Mr. Cuccioli is Rocco Lazzara, and he's just come back from, we're not quite certain if it's a prison, if it's a hospital, but he's had some issues. It's never really quite made clear if he was incarcerated or just getting medical help, but whatever the case may be, his wife doesn't want him back particularly, and his oldest son, Sibby, does not want him back under any circumstances. Go away. We want no part of you whatsoever. And the poor guy does come home trying to make good. He really has the best intentions in his heart. What happens, however, is when they tell him they don't want him, he tries to placate them. He tries to be nice. And then, inevitably, he just loses it and goes off and gets very violent. And then he apologizes. And we're back in that same cycle again where he tries very hard to be a good guy. And there's only so much good guyism you can do. And that's what happens in this play over and over and over again. Now, the one thing that's a bit problematic to me is the play takes place in 1964. And I'm not going to say very much about the fact that Robert Redford is mentioned as a sex symbol. I mean, I guess they went to the Biltmore Theater and saw Barefoot in the Park because that's what he was doing then. I mean, I don't think Robert Redford became a sex symbol until the end of the decade when he did Butch Cassidy. But more significantly, for 1964, one of the sons is very out about being gay. And I don't know if you're that out about being gay in an Italian-American family in 1964. Even if you are, everybody takes it much better than I think they would have in 1964. I'm not saying they say, oh, well, honey, as long as you're in love. You know, no, nothing like that. I don't mean that at all. But nevertheless, they take it far better than I would expect any family did. I don't know if Joe Pantaro went through this, if indeed this is his life story. I don't know if this is a case where he's just remembering what went on in his home. But I can't imagine that it went on in many homes in 1964. So I think that's a big problem with the play. And I see no reason, frankly, why it has to be in 1964. I think the play would have profited from being in the here and now, because the way the parents seem to take the gayism factor is much more in line with what we're seeing today. Would that in 1964, that this were the way parents accepted their gay son? There's another son, too, in the piece as well, who's doing his best to be supportive of his father. And what, of course, happens is that he gets into trouble with his mother and brother as a result of that. They don't want the father back. So that adds more strife. I will have to admit that they're in the wrong theater. this is a big play. It needs a lot of, it needs two bedrooms as well as a living room and a dining area, because of course it's an Italian play, so people are going to eat, right? So it's much too small at the tiny little theater in Theater Row that it's in. It's the first one you go in on the right-hand side. And so the suggestions of the bedrooms are so minimal that it takes a while before you realize that these really are bedrooms. The mother has her issues, too. She's very well played by Angelina Fiordalisi, who is very good at these Italian roles. She certainly has a very commendable Italian accent. As it turns out, she's an immigrant. It was one of those stories where he went over to Italy and he found this woman, and actually he was in love with her sister first. And so she feels like he settled for second best. But she has issues about being in this country and would like to go back to where she came from. Unfortunately, she's agoraphobic and she hasn't been out of the house since like 1904. But anyway, that's a complication as well. But I'm telling you, if you groove on people fighting, if you groove on hair trigger personalities that can really go off the deep end at any given second, this is a play that you might enjoy. But it's pretty harrowing stuff.
Sounds like Thanksgiving at my house.
Indeed. I understand. My heart goes out to you.
Yeah, it's funny. I had heard when I got the press release, Peter, I don't think I had ever heard of the play. But as you say, I believe it was pretty well known in its day.
Yeah. I think so. I certainly knew of it. I never saw it before. But this was one that was very much talked about when it was first done. Frankly, I don't even know when that was, but it does have this reputation. And in that sense, it's nice when a play from way back when gets another chance, given that it got a good reception the first time around. But tough stuff.
So, Michael, you got a chance to see Pretty Filthy by the Civilians. Why don't you tell us about that?
You sleaze.
Filthy. I would say actually the title is the best thing about it, or one of the best things about it. This is a show about people who work in the porn movie industry, and it's based on actual interviews, and it's one of those genre where the actual interviews are taken and pretty much put on stage, adapted somewhat, but even the lyrics, the song lyrics, are actual almost verbatim what these people said, and then they were formed into songs by Michael Friedman, composer lyricist in this case. I thought that it had many moments, but it was it's tricky to begin with because the humor in it, in order to find humor in it, you have to really not think a lot about it. Why the characters are doing this, why they turn to porn, and there are lots of different stories from lots of different people, and some of the characters seem much more mentally healthy than others, but obviously there is the stigma, and it's something that really is not easy to get away from. Although I think many people seem to feel that it's less so nowadays because of the changes in the porn industry and the fact there's so much amateur porn and people are maybe more accepting and more understanding of certain things like that, as long as they involve consenting adults. But it's still a pretty edgy subject for a musical, I would say. And I thought it worked in many places, as I said, but my main problem with it was that when you do that kind of a musical where you take verbatim text and set it to music and just change it a little bit to try to make songs out of it, that's not easy. And in this case, it really got very tiresome for me after a while. Because of the things you have to do to make these speeches into songs, you do a lot of repetition. You have a lot of false rhymes, which would have, I think, driven Peter up the wall. But some people are more adept at it than others. And in this case, I just really didn't think Michael Friedman did a very good job with it at all. I was trying to think of a recent show that was similar in that regard, and it was that. What was the title of the show? Was it Found?
Yeah, Found, indeed.
Yeah, the one about the people who find the little notes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That, I thought, the score in that was more successful overall than this one. So that was my feeling. That was my personal reaction to it. And I would have liked the show on the whole a lot better if I had liked the way that that it was adapted musically. But there's a lot of talent in it. It's done by the Civilians, as I said, down on the Abrams Arts Center at the Henry Street Settlement, which is one of the most remote theater locations in Manhattan that I've ever been to. Mm-hmm. It is quite a lovely theater when you get into it. So you might want to take it in if you are feeling adventurous. It's very tame. It's quite tame overall, considering the subject matter. There is no really nothing even approaching full frontal nudity. But the cast is very strong. John Bellman, Lulu Fall, Elise Allen Louis, Luba Mason is in it. And she, it was, again, someone I haven't seen on stage in quite some time. It was great to see her. She still has a fabulous voice. Maria Cristina Oliveras, Steve Rosen, Jared Zarilli, and Marek Smith, who was recently in The Underclassmen, who was so good in that. So there's a lot of talent, a lot of talent involved. I just, I didn't think that the result was as successful as it could have been.
It's funny. Recently, I met Jack Urbant, who wrote the off-Broadway musical All in Love, which has a wonderful score to it. But that was in 1961. In 1969, he did a musical called Stag Movie that played off-Broadway. Adrian Barbeau was in it, in fact. And I said to him, wow, you know, I'd love to hear Stag Movie. He said, let me see what I can round up for you. Let me see what I can. And I thought, oh, I'm going to hear this score with all these double entendre songs and all this kind of business. And he gave me a CD and said, this is all I could find. And it was the overture. And that's it. That's all I have. So I have no idea how filthy Stag Movie was or how innocent it was, you know, in comparison or anything like that. Michael, you bring up False Rhymes, and we should talk about that in terms of Hamilton, because people are going to say to me, excuse me, here you are raving about Hamilton, but there are false rhymes in Hamilton.
Thank you for bringing it up, because I would like to talk about that. You go first.
Okay. All right. Fine. In a way, he gets away with it because there's so much rhyming that it goes so fast, you're not even sure if that thing you just heard was a rhyme. But I have to give him credit for when he does rhyme, which I say is far more often than not. He comes up with a lot of clever images. there was one even that I thought was wonderful. This isn't quite the line. I'm paraphrasing, but it's very close to this. Your perfume tells me that your father has money. Wow, that's a good line. You know, I mean, you know, that somebody knows that somebody's rich because of the perfume. Wow. Miranda's paying attention.
Somebody in back of me really chuckled at that line. I remember it specifically. Yes.
So what were you going to say about the false rhymes?
Oh, just that there are false rhymes that are really lame. And then there are false rhymes that are really so clever that they're, to me, they're as good as real rhymes. There are so many in this. I wanted to write some down, but everything was moving so fast.
It does.
The one I remember, the one I always cite from In the Heights that I love so much is cold porter and cold water.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't quite explain it. When he does it, it sounds like he's doing it on purpose and because he's so creative and saying, well, I know these two things don't rhyme, but they sound – they're homophonic to an extent. And so I'm presenting them to you, and it's almost more clever than an exact rhyme, whereas many other false rhymes are just lazy. I can't explain it any better than that. You just have to hear it.
And while we're talking about porno, my upcoming column for Masterworks Broadway deals with Women's History Month, because that's March. I don't know if you know that. We know Black History Month is February, but Women's History Month is March. So I decided to see if I could find an event for every day that would celebrate Women's History Month. For example, March 1st was the day Sweeney Todd opened in 1979, and certainly this would be a good day to play Angela Lansbury's songs, so that type of thing. March 6th, for example, would be the 41st anniversary of Over Here opening, which was a musical that starred the Andrews Sisters, so why don't you play that? Well, I found out March 2nd was Lorelei Lee's birthday. Not our Lorelei Lee, not Carol Channing, not Megan Hilty. No. I didn't know this. There's a porno star named Lorelei Lee. Did you know that? She's the star of Milk Nymphos, which I understand deals with the enema community. Anyway, she claims she got her name from Marilyn Monroe in Gentlemen for a Blondes. That's how she knows her. But as we know, Carol Channing came first.
Yes.
See what we can learn on a Sunday morning.
The Lord's Day, right. Yeah.
All right. So we started this segment off on talking about Pretty Filthy by the Civilians. And the only thing I can add to that is that If you have not listened to the Civilians podcast, you should. The Civilians put out a podcast periodically called Let Me Ascertain You, and it's very interesting, and it's a lot of it is I don't know if a lot of it is correct, but the things that I can remember from it are all about their interviews that they do with folks, and they do dramatic readings of those interviews, the direct text from those interviews. So check it out. Civilians are a very talented group of folks. Let's knock one more out. Peter, you saw John and Jen. I'm interested to hear about this, so why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, Andrew Lippin's musical that was at the Lambs many moons ago has come back courtesy of the Keen Company. The Keen Company does wonderful work and has for a long, long time. And they don't often do musicals, but here's one that they are doing. And the last one they did was Marry Me a Little. Mm. So once again, they have gone to a two-person musical. I guess that's what the budget allows. and that's fine. But, I mean, it's nice to see Andrew Lippin's John and Jen back on the boards, because we don't usually get a musical about a brother and a sister. What is compelling about this show is that traditionally, at least from the brothers and sisters I've observed, I'm an only child, but they tend to fight when they're young, and as they get older, they make peace and even come to love each other. Uh-huh. Quite the opposite happens here. This is a brother and sister. Well, she's 6 years older, for one thing, and she's very, very territorial about him. She essentially is a surrogate mother, because we don't get much sense of who the mother is, but we certainly get a sense of who the father is, and he seems quite abusive. He seems like one of these military types who wants his boy to grow up to be a man and won't take anything less. And he's convinced the son that when he hits him, it's for his own good, and that it will make a man out of him, all that stuff. So, but Jen, the sister, knows better. She knows that that he's just a bully and a terrible human being. And so she's going to be the parent that isn't there. But that only goes so far, because as they get older, he becomes more conservative and she becomes more liberal. And that's a real problem for them. Politically, they don't see eye to eye. Like the Snowwalker, we're talking about that era, the 60s. And indeed, she goes off to New York and becomes quite the liberal. And he's going to stay home and he's going to show his father that he can become a man. And he's going to go serve in Vietnam, because that's what real men do. So she's, of course, aghast at this, because she's so anti-war. She sees no point in the Vietnam War, as so many of us did. So under those circumstances, it's a real gulf between them. I don't think I should tell you what happens, but let me say that in the second act, we also get John and Jen, but it isn't the same John. I'll be enigmatic. I think the show should be called John and Jen and John, by the way. Again,
that's
a great idea. Yeah, I'm afraid I'm not explaining well enough, but that's on purpose. Well, any opportunity to see Kate Baldwin, and she is magnificent in the part. If you haven't caught up with Kate Baldwin yet, really, this is the time to do it. I guess any time would be the time to do it. She's really one of our most stunning leading ladies. She has everything. She has the look. She has the figure. She has the voice. She has the acting chops. She truly, truly, truly is sensational in this role. And, you know, holding stage with her can't be easy, because she really is such an accomplished and certainly an actress who has had many, many more opportunities than the young man playing opposite her. He's Connor Ryan, and he really holds his own very well with her. In a sense, his part is more difficult. This is also a show about letting go, about how much of a parent can you be? How much of a parent should you be? And, of course, the theme of Into the Woods comes into play here. Children go from something you love to something you lose. that comes into play as well here. That line isn't quite used. Music is quite lovely. Lyrics are quite fine. It's a musical that more people should get to know. And I think this is a good time to do it. It's in the same complex, Theater Row, as the Snowwalker is. It's downstairs. And it's worth climbing the flight of stairs after you leave. So by all means, consider going to Judd and Jen.
I'm seeing it on Tuesday, looking forward to it. But I was just wanted to say I would think that Andrew Lippis shares your high opinion of Kate Baldwin, because aside from being in this, she was also in Big Fish.
Yeah, right. Yeah, sure.
Mm. So, yeah, I guess they have a mutual admiration society there.
So Michael got a chance to see Jesse Norman at Carnegie Hall. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Jesse Norman, the great opera star who really, as far as I know, does not sing very often anymore at all. So it was quite an occasion, Valentine's Day night at Carnegie Hall in the big room. And the program was titled Hooray for Love, which is a song by
Harold Arlen, right?
Harold Arlen and Leo Robin. Yes, I just wanted to get the lyricist right. And this was largely an evening of musical theater and American songbook standards. A lot of Jerome Kern, a lot of Rodgers and Hart, a lot of the Gershwins. Two of the highlights were just with piano, beautifully played by Mark Markham, and then on some numbers you had Colin Davin on guitar and mandolin, and then the great bassist Ron Carter came out for a lot of songs too. Two of the highlights were, it's so interesting at this point how someone can take a really old song and give it completely new life. She did Falling in Love from The Voice from Syracuse, Falling in Love with Love, in a very, very slow, sad, introspective arrangement. And the song is about falling out of love, basically. So, but it's a waltz. And any time I've heard it, it's always really been pretty up-tempo. Mm-hmm. So you would think that I would have heard it done like this before, but I don't think I ever had. It was very, very slow and very gentle and sad and introspective, and it was fantastic. And then on the other hand, she did But Not For Me, the Gershwin song, with a sort of a light bossa nova beat. And that, of course, that's also about, you know, everybody's in love but me. So really, really fantastic arrangements. She is one of the great voices in history. It was a privilege to be there. I would use this occasion to unfortunately have to do another lecture on audience behavior. And, you know, I know the people we're talking to are not the people we need to be talking to. But maybe if you know other people like this, please tell them not to be scrolling through photos and texts on their phone while a great opera singer is singing on stage in front of you, because you're going to distract other people in the audience and possibly even the person on stage, depending on where you're singing. At one point, Jesse Norman leaned over and begged someone in the audience to turn their phone off.
Wow.
And then this woman two rows in front of me, who was, first of all, like dressed in a tracksuit or something like that, with a big shopping bag, you know, like one of those people. Her phone went off and rang at the end of one of the most quiet, beautiful numbers. And then not only that, she eventually put the phone off. Everybody sighed. Everybody gasped. Everybody grumbled. Then she waited until the middle of the next song to stand up and walk out up the aisle. And I just really almost wanted to go after her and say, how dare you? I mean, all of the songs were quite short. These were popular songs. I would say 2.5-3 minutes was the greatest length of anything she sang. And that woman, this woman knew that by that point, because every song had been like that. She could not wait 2 minutes. It's really appalling. And you know, you always wonder, do these people pay for their tickets? Do they somehow? I've always heard box office people say that the people who pay the least are the most rude. Maybe she got, I don't know, maybe somebody gave it to her. Maybe she won a lottery. I don't know. But Jesus.
Michael, one of the problems that opera singers usually have when they take on popular songs is that they want to show off they have beautiful voices, and almost act as if they're slumming by doing musical theater. Was any of this in evidence?
You know, thank you for asking that. Not at all. Mm-hmm. And I have never heard her sing this repertoire before. Somehow she's able to adapt her voice so that it doesn't sound at all fake or pretentious. Very few people are able to do it. Eileen Farrell back in the day was very famous, but that's a little different because when she sang pop songs, she would sing in a completely different register, basically in her belt, lower alto register. But some other people, like Leontine Price, who has a fantastic popular album that she made in 1967 called Right as the Rain, she does it beautifully, and so does Jesse Norman. There are a few others that I can't Dawn Upshaw. But that's a different type of a voice, so that doesn't really apply either. There are very few because they're not trained for that. They're trained for something completely different.
Sure.
So it was a very pleasant surprise. I mean, I just wanted to go to hear her because, as I say, she hardly ever sings anymore. But I did not expect it to be that successful.
All right. I guess that wraps it up for today. Before we go into our trivia discussion for the day, I want to remind you that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us on iTunes. You can listen to us on Stitcher, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, Android device, and that'll be automatically streamed to you. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about George Spelvin. What was the answer there?
I think we gave that one. That was Walter Plinge. The one I think we did was about when I asked about the play that had opened and it got such bad reviews.
Oh, that's
that,
right.
The producers decided to charge $1 for tickets. And the first week it sold out. And so the second week they said, all right, let's try $1, but $2 for Friday and Saturday. And it sold out. And then they didn't have any money left because they weren't making expenses with those meager admission prices. So, anyway, what was the play? It was called In Things That Go Bump in the Night, and it's almost 50 years ago because it was Terrence McNally's first play. And we talked about this the other night when we were at NYU, where A Man of No Importance was done, and I brought this up. And he again reiterated something he had told me before, that if that had not happened to him, he would not be the playwright he is today, because when nobody is in the house, you don't learn anything from an audience. But when you have full houses, you learn something. And when he saw 15 full houses react the same way each night, sometimes he had them, sometimes he lost them. He could tell when they were getting antsy. He could tell when they were compelled. And he said it was the best playwriting lesson he could have ever had. So bless Ted Mann, the producer, who was a magnificent producer anyway, who gave us The Long Day's Journey Into Night and plenty of other classics, starting off Broadway with The Iceman Cometh, really doing tremendously significant work. And really, we have him to thank for Terrence McNally's career. Of course, McNally as well, but you know what I mean, that this really helped him tremendously. So that was the play, and that was the author, and that was the situation back in 1965 at the Royal Theater, which is now the Jacobs Theater, which is now playing a play by Terrence McNally. It's Only a Play Is There, you know, and which of course deals with reading bad reviews. And back in April of 65, Terrence McNally was reading plenty of bad reviews and didn't think he'd ever read any other bad reviews or any good reviews, because that was the end of him. And it certainly wasn't, to say the least. All right, this week's trivia question. I'm going to mention two songs, and I want to know how they're linked in a very distinctive way. Okay, I'm not just dealing with the fact that they came from movies starring the same person. I don't mean that. But the songs are It Takes a Woman and She Wasn't You. Those are the two songs I'm dealing with. What interesting thing have these two songs in common? That's the trivia question for this week.
All right. So if you do know those answers, do not take your phone out in the middle of a show and send us an email. But as soon as you get out of the theater, please let us know. And that'll about wrap up for this week. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If I were you, you're not. I'm the hanger-on, I'm the sideshow, while you are the main event. I'll be standing by in the sideshow while you play the center tent. I don't want to stay on the sidelines while you make a major play. All I want to do is run away. There will come a day I'm the sideshow while you're in the center ring. Happiness for you is what I'd show.